This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Iron Hand's Daughter, written by David Gemmell and read by Achua Ando. Prologue. Sunlight glinted on steel as the knife blade spun through the air to thud home in the chalk-circled center of the board. The woman chuckled.
"You lose again, Ballister," she said.
"I let you win," the dwarf told her, "for I am a creature of legend, and my skills are second to none."
He smiled as he spoke, but there was sadness in his dark eyes, and she reached out to cup her hand to his bearded cheek. He leaned in to her touch, twisting his head to kiss her palm.
"You are the finest of men," she said softly, "and the gods, if gods there be, have not been kind to you."
Ballister did not reply. Glancing up, he drank in her beauty, the golden sheen of her skin, the haunting power of her pale blue-gray eyes. At 19, Sigani was the most beautiful woman Ballister had ever seen, tall and slender, full-lipped and firm-breasted. Her only flaw was her close-cropped hair, which shone like silver in the sunlight. It had turned grey in her 6th year, after her parents were slain. The villagers called it the Night of the Slaughterers, and no one would speak of it. Pushing himself to his feet, he walked to the fence post, climbing the rail to pull Sigani's throwing knife from the board. She watched him stretching out his tiny arms, his stunted fingers unable to curl fully around the hilt of her blade. At last he wrenched it clear, then turned and jumped to the ground. He was no larger than a child of 4, yet his head was huge and his face heavily bearded. Ballister returned her blade, and she slid it home into the sheath at her hip. Reaching to her right, she lifted a pitcher of cool water and filled 2 clay goblets, passing one to the dwarf. Ballister gave a wide grin as he took it, then slowly passed his tiny hand across the surface of the water. She shook her head.
"You should not make those gestures, my friend," she said seriously. "If you were seen by the wrong man, you would be flogged."
"I've been flogged before. Did I show you my scars?"
"Many times."
"Then I shall not concern myself with fears of the lash,"
he said, passing his hand once more over the drink.
"To the long-dead king over the water," he said, lifting the goblet to his lips.
A sleek black hound padded into sight. Heavy of shoulder, slim of flanks, she was a hare and rabbit hound, and her speed was legendary. Highland hunting hounds were bred for strength, stamina, and obedience, but most of all, they had to be fast. None was swifter than Sigani's hound. Ballister laid down his empty goblet and called to her.
"Here, lady."
Her head came up and she loped to him, pushing her long muzzle into his beard, licking at his cheek.
"Women find me irresistible," he said as he stroked the hound's ears.
"I can see why," Sigani told him. "You have a gentle touch."
Ballister stroked Lady's flanks and gazed down into her eyes. One eye was dough brown, the other opal grey.
"She has healed well,"
he said, running his finger down the scar on the hound's cheek. Sigani nodded, and Ballister saw the fresh flaring of anger in her eyes.
"Bent is a fool. I should never have allowed him to come, stupid man." "That stupid man loves you," chided Ballister. "As do we all, princess."
"Idiot," she snapped, but the anger faded from her eyes.
"You know I have no right to such a title."
"Not so, Sigarni. You have the blood of Gandarin in your veins."
"Pah! Half the population have his blood. The man was a rutting ram. Gwalchmai told me about him. He said Gandarin could have raised an army of his bastard offspring. Even Bernt probably has a drop or two of Gandarin's blood."
"You should forgive him," advised Ballister. "He didn't mean it."
At that moment, a red hawk swooped low over the clearing, coming to rest on a nearby bow perch. For a moment or two, It pranced from foot to foot, then cocked its head and stared at the silver-haired woman. The hound gave a low growl, but slunk back close to Ballastar. Tsigane pulled on a long black gauntlet of polished leather and stood, arm outstretched. The hawk launched itself from the fence and flew to her.
"Ah, my beauty," said Tsigane, reaching up and ruffling the russet-coloured feathers of the bird's breast.
Taking a strip of rabbit meat from the pouch at her side, she fed it to the hawk. Swiftly and skillfully she attached two soft collars to the hawk's legs, then threaded short hunting jesses through brass-rimmed holes in the collars. Lastly, she pulled a soft leather hood from the pouch at her side and smoothly stroked it into place over the bird's beak and eyes. The hawk sat motionless as the hood settled, and even turned her neck to allow Tsigane to lean forward and tighten the braces at the rear. The woman turned her gaze back to the dwarf and smiled.
"I know that Bernd acted from stupidity, and I am more angry with myself than with him. I told him to loose Lady only if there was a second hare. It was a simple instruction, but he was incapable even of that, and I will not have fools around me."
Ballastar said nothing more. There were, he knew, only two creatures in all the world that Tsigane cared for. The hound, Lady, and the hawk, Abby. Tsigane had been training them both, determined that they would work together as a team. The training had gone well. Lady would seek out the hares and scatter them, while Abby swooped down from the trees in a kill that seemed swifter than an arrow. The danger area came when only a single quarry was sighted. Hawk and bird had raced each other to make the strike. Abby won both times. On the second occasion when Lady darted in to try to steal the kill, Abby had lashed out, her beak grazing the hound's flank. Tsigane had grabbed Lady's collar, dragging her back. In an effort to retrain Lady, Tsigane had allowed the cattle herder Bernd to accompany her on the training hunts. His duty was to keep Lady leashed, and only release her when more than one hare was sighted. He had failed. Excited by the hunt, Bernd had loosed the hound at first sight of a single hare. Abby had swooped upon it, and Lady had sped in to share the prize. The hawk had turned, lashing out with her cruel beak, piercing the hound's right eye.
"You are hunting today?" asked the dwarf.
"No, Abby is above her killing weight. I let her have the last hare we took yesterday. Today we'll just walk a while up to the High Druin. She likes to fly there."
"Watch out for the sorcerer," warned Ballastar.
"There is no need to fear him," said Tsigane. "I think he is a good man."
"He is an outlander, and his skin has been burned by sorcery. He makes me shudder."
Tsigane's laughter pealed out.
"Oh, Ballastar, you fool! In his land, all people have dark skins. They are not cursed."
"He is a wizard. At night, he becomes a giant bird that flies across High Druin. Many have seen it. A great black raven, twice normal size, and his castle is full of grimoires and spells. And there are animals there, frozen. You know Marion, she was there. She told us all about a great black bear that just stands in the hallway, a spell upon it. You keep clear of him, Tsigane."
She looked into his dark eyes and saw the reality of his fear.
"I shall be careful," she said. "You may rely on it. But I will not walk in fear, Ballastar. Have I not the blood of Gandarin in my veins?"
Tsigane could not quite mask the smile as she spoke.
"You should not mock your friends," he scolded. "Magickers are to be avoided. Anyone with sense knows that. And what is he doing here, in our high, lonely places, eh? Why did he leave his land of black people and come here? What is he seeking? Or is he perhaps hiding from justice?"
"I shall ask him when next I see him," she said. "Come, Lady!"
The hound rose warily and paced alongside the tall woman. Tsigane knelt and patted her flanks.
"You've learned to respect Abby now," she whispered, "though I fear she will never learn respect for you." "Why is that?" asked Ballastar.
Tsigane looked up.
"'Tis the way of the hawk, my friend. It loves no one, needs no one, fears no one."
"Does it not love you, Sigourney?"
"No. That is why she must never be called in vain. Each time she flies to the fist, I feed her. The day I do not, she may decide never to return. Hawks know no loyalties. They stay because they choose to. No man, nor woman, can ever own one."
Without a word of farewell, the huntress strode off into the forest. Chapter 1 Tovey closed the double doors of his oven, removed his apron and wiped the flour from his face with a clean towel. The day's bread was laid out on wooden trays, stacked six high, and the smell of the baking filled his nostrils. Even after all these years, he still loved that smell. Taking a sample loaf, he cut through the center. It was rich and light, with no pockets of air. Behind him, his apprentice, Stulf, breathed a silent sigh of relief. Tovey turned to the boy. "Not bad," he said. Cutting two thick slices, he smeared them with fresh butter and passed one to the boy. Moving to the rear door, Tovey stepped outside. Above the stone and timber buildings of the village, the dawn sun was clearing the peaks, and a fresh breeze was blowing from the north. The bakery stood at the center of the village, an old three-story building that once had been the council house. "In the days when we are allowed a council," thought Tovey sourly. The building surrounding the bakery was sturdily built and old. Further down the hill were the simpler timber dwellings of the poorer folk. Tovey stepped out into the road and gazed down the hill to the river. The villagers were stirring, and several women were already kneeling by the waterside washing clothes and blankets, beating them against the white rocks at the water's edge. Tovey saw the black-clad widow Maffrey making her way to the communal well. He waved and smiled, and she nodded as she passed. The smith, Graham, was lighting his forge. Seeing Tovey, he strolled across. Soot had smeared the smith's thick white beard.
"Good day to you, baker," said Graham. "And to you. Looks like a fine one. Nary a cloud in sight. I see you have the baron's greys in your stalls. Fine beasts. Finer than the man who owns them. One of them has a split hoof and both carry spur scars. No way to treat good horses. I'll take a loaf, if you please, one with a crust as black as sin and a centre as white as a nun's soul." Tovey shook his head. "You'll take what I give you, man, and be glad of it. We'll not taste a better piece of bread anywhere in the kingdom. Stulf! Fetch a loaf for the smith."
The boy brought it out, wrapped in muslin. Dipping his huge hand into the pocket of his leather apron, Graham produced two small copper coins, which he dropped into Stealth's outstretched palm. The boy bowed and backed away.
"It'll be a good summer," said Graham, tearing off a chunk of bread and pushing it into his mouth. "Let us hope so," said Tovey.
The dwarf Ballister approached them, labouring up the steep hill. He gave an elaborate bow.
"Good morning to you," said Ballister. "Am I late for breakfast?" "Not if you have coin, little man," said Tovey, eyes narrowing.
The dwarf made him feel uncomfortable, and he found himself growing irritable.
"No coin," the dwarf told him affably, "but I have three hairs hanging." "Caught by Sigourney, no doubt," snapped the baker. "I don't know why she should be so generous with you." "Perhaps she likes me," answered Ballister, no trace of anger in his tone.
Tovey called for another loaf, which he gave the dwarf.
"Bring me the best hare tonight," he said.
"Why does they anger you so?" asked Graham as the dwarf wandered away.
Tovey shrugged.
"He's cursed. He should have been laid aside at birth. What good is he to man or beast? He cannot hunt, cannot work. If not for Sigourney, maybe he would leave the village. He could join a circus. Such as he could earn an honest living there, capering and the like."
"You're turning into a sour old man, Tovey."
"And you were getting fat."
"Aye, that's the truth. But I still remember the wearing of the red. That's something I'll take to the grave with pride, as will you."
The baker nodded and his expression softened.
Bonny days, Graham. They'll not come again.
We gave them a fight, though, eh?
Tovey shook his head.
We showed them how brave men die. That's not the same, my friend. Outnumbered and outclassed we were, their knights riding through our ranks, cutting and killing, our sword blades clanging against their armour and causing no damage. God's man, it was slaughter that day. I wish to heaven I'd never seen it.
We were badly led, whispered Graham. Ganderin did not pass his strength to his sons. The smith sighed. Ah, well, enough dismal talk. This is a new day, fresh and untainted.
Spinning on his heel, the burly blacksmith strode back to his forge. The boy Stealth said nothing as Tovey re-entered the bakery. He could see his master was deep in thought, and he had heard a little of the conversation. It was hard to believe that fat Tovey had once worn the red, and had taken part in the Battle of Culloden Moor. Stealth had visited the battle site last autumn. A huge plain dotted with barrows, 34 in all, and each barrow held the dead of an entire clan's fighting men. The wind had howled across Culloden Moor, and Stealth had been frightened by the power and the haunted wailing of it. His uncle, Mart One Arm, had stood with him, his bony hand on the boy's shoulder.
"This is the place where dreams end, boy. This is the resting place of hope."
"How many died, uncle?"
"Scores of thousands."
"But not the king?"
"No, not the king. He fled to a bright land beyond the water, and they found him there and slew him. There are no mountain kings now."
Uncle Mark walked him on to the moor, coming at last to a high barrow.
"This is where the Lord of Men stood, shoulder to shoulder, brothers in arms, brothers in death."
Lifting the stump of his left arm, he gave a crooked smile.
"Part of me is buried here too, boy, and more than just my arm. My heart lies here with my brothers and cousins and friends."
Stealth dragged his mind back to the present. Tovey was standing by the window, his eyes showing the same faraway look he had seen that day on the face of Mark One Arm.
"Can I take some bread to me, ma'am?"
asked Stealth.
Tovey nodded. Stealth chose two loaves and wrapped them. He had reached the door when Tovey's voice stopped him.
"What do you want to be, lad, when you're grown?"
"A baker, sir. Skilled like you."
Tovey said no more, and the boy hurried from the bakery. Sigarni loved the mountain lands, the lush valleys nestling between them, and the deep dark forests that covered their flanks. But mostly, she loved High Druin, the lonely peak which towered over the highlands, its summit lost in cloud, its shoulders cloaked in snow. There was in High Druin an elemental magnificence that radiated from its sharp, defiant crags, a magic that sang in the whispering of wind breath before the winter storms. High Druin spoke to the heart. He said,
"I am eternity in stone. I have always been here. I will always be here."
The huntress let Abby soar into the air and watched her swoop over High Druin's lower flanks. Lady bounded out over the grass, her sleek black body alert, her one good eye scanning for sign of hare or rat. Sigarni sat by the Lake of Tears, watching the brightly coloured ducks on the banks of the small island at the centre of the lake. Abby circled high above them, also watching the birds. The hawk swooped down, coming to rest in a tree beside the lake. The ducks, suddenly aware of the hawk, took to the water. Sigarni watched with interest. Roast duck would make a fine contrast to the hare meat she had eaten during the last fortnight.
"Here, lady," she called.
The hound padded alongside, and Sigarni pointed to the ducks.
"Oh!"
hissed Sigarni. Instantly, the dog leapt into the water, paddling furiously towards the circling flock. Several of the birds took wing, putting flat distance between them and the hound, keeping low to the water. But one,
took off into the sky, and instantly Abby launched herself in pursuit. The duck was rising fast, and Abby hurtled down towards it with talons extended. At the last possible moment, the duck saw the bird of prey and dived fast. For a heartbeat only, Tsigane thought Abby had her prey, but then the duck hit the water, diving deep, confusing the hawk. Abby circled and returned to her branch. The huntress gave a low whistle, summoning Lady back to the bank. The sound of a walking horse came to Tsigane then, and she rose and turned. The horse was a tall chestnut, and upon it rode a black man, his cheeks, head and shoulders covered in a flowing white burnous. A cloak of blue-dyed wool hung from his broad shoulders, and a curved sword was scabbarded at his waist. He smiled as he saw the mountain woman.
"When hunting duck, it is better for the hawk to take it from below," he said, swinging down from his saddle.
"We're still learning," replied Tsigane affably. "She's wedded to fur now, but it took time, as you said it would, Asmodeer."
The tall man sat down at the water's edge. Lady approached him gingerly, and he stroked her head.
"The eye is healing well. Has it affected her hunting?"
Tsigane shook her head.
"And the bird? Hawks prefer to feed on feather. What is her killing weight?"
£2 2 ounces. But she is taken here at 2-4.
"And what do you feed her?"
"No more than 3 ounces a day."
The black man nodded.
"Once in a while you should catch her a rat. Nothing better for cleaning a bird's crop than a good rat."
"Why is that, Asmodeer?"
asked Tsigane, sitting down beside the man.
"I don't know,"
he admitted with a broad smile.
"My father told me years ago. As you know, the hawk swallows its prey, where it can, whole, and the carcass is compressed, all the goodness squeezed out of it. It then vomits out the cast, the remnants. There is, I would imagine, something in the rat's pelt or skin that cleans the bird's crop as it exits."
Leaning back on his elbows, he narrowed his eyes and watched the distant hawk.
"How many kills so far?"
68 hares, 20 pigeons, and a ferret.
"You hunt ferret?"
asked Asmodeer, raising a quizzical eyebrow.
"It was a mistake. The ferret bolted a hare, and Abby took the ferret."
Asmodeer chuckled.
"You have done well, Tsigane. I am glad I gave you the hawk."
3 times I thought I'd lost her. Always in the forest."
"You may lose sight of her, child. But she will never lose sight of you. Come back to the castle, and I will prepare you a meal. And you too,"
he said, scratching the hound's ears.
"I was told that you were a sorcerer, and that I must beware of you."
"You should always heed the warnings of dwarves,"
he said,
"or any creature of legend."
"How did you know it was Ballister?"
"Because I am a sorcerer, my dear. We are expected to know things like that." "You always pause at my bear,"
said Asmodeer, gazing fondly at the silver-haired girl, as Tsigane reached out and touched the fur of the beast's belly. It was a huge creature, its paws outstretched, talons bared, mouth open in a silent roar.
"It is wonderful," she said. "How is it done?"
"You do not believe it is a spell, then?"
he asked, smiling.
"No."
"Well,"
he said slowly, rubbing his chin.
"If it is not a spell, then it must be a stuffed bear. There are craftsmen in my land who work on carcasses, stripping away the inner meat, which can rot, and rebuilding the dead beasts with clay, before wrapping them once more in their skins or fur. The results are remarkably lifelike."
"And this, then, is a stuffed bear?"
"I did not say that,"
he reminded her.
"Come, let us eat."
Asmodeer led her through the hallway, and into the main hall. A log fire was burning merrily in the hearth, and two servants were laying platters of meat and bread on the table. Both were tall, dark-skinned men who worked silently, never once looking at their master or his guest. With the table laid, they silently withdrew.
"Your servants are not friendly," commented Sigani.
"They are efficient," said Asmodeus, seating himself at the table and filling a goblet with wine.
"Do they fear you?"
"A little fear is good for a servant."
"Do they love you?"
"I
am not a man easy to love. My servants are content. They are free to leave my service whenever it pleases them so to do. They are not slaves."
He offered Sigani some wine, but she refused and he poured water into a glazed goblet, which he passed to her. They ate in silence. Then Asmodeus moved to the fireside, beckoning Sigani to join him.
"Do you have no fear?"
the black man asked, as she sat cross-legged before him.
"Of what?"
she countered.
"Of life, of death, of me."
"Why would I fear you?"
"Why would you not? When we met last year, I was a stranger in your land, black and fearsome,"
he said, widening his eyes and mimicking a snarl. She laughed at him.
"You were never fearsome," she said. "Dangerous, yes, but never fearsome."
"There is a difference?"
"Of course," she told him, cocking her head to one side. "I like dangerous men."
He shook his head.
"You are incorrigible, Sigourney. The body of an angel and the mind of a whore. Usually that is considered a wonderful combination. That is, if you are contemplating the life of a courtesan, a prostitute, or a slut. Is that your ambition?"
Sigourney yawned theatrically.
"I think it is time to go home," she said, rising smoothly.
"Ah, I have offended you,"
he said.
"Not at all," she told him. "But I expected better of you, Asmodeus."
"You should expect better of yourself, Sigourney. There are dark days looming. A leader is coming, a leader of noble blood. You will probably be called upon in those days to aid him, for you also boast the blood of Gandarin. Men will follow an angel or a saint. They will follow a despot and a villain, but they will follow a whore only to the bedchamber."
Her face flushed with anger.
"I'll take sermons from a priest, not from a man who's happy to cavort with me throughout the spring and summer, and now seeks to belittle me. I am not some milkmaid or tavern wench. I am Sigourney of the Mountains. What I do is my affair. I used you for pleasure. I admit it freely. You are a fine lover. You have strength and finesse, and you used me. That made it a balanced transaction, and neither of us was sullied by it. How dare you attempt to shame me?"
"Why would you see it as shame?"
he countered.
"I am talking of perceptions, the perceptions of men. You think I look down upon you? I do not. I adore you for your body and your mind. Father, I am probably as much as I am capable of it, a little in love with you. But this is not why I spoke in the way I did."
"I don't care,"
she told him.
"Goodbye."
Sigourney strode from the room and out past the great bear. A servant pushed open the double doors and she walked down the steps into the courtyard. Lady came bounding towards her. Another servant, a slim, dark-eyed young man, was waiting at the foot of the steps with Abby hooded upon his wrist. Sigourney pulled on her hawking glove.
"You were waiting for me?"
she asked the young man. He nodded.
"Why? I'm usually here for hours."
"The master said today would be a short visit,"
he explained. Sigourney untied the braces and slid the hood clear of Abby's eyes. The hawk looked around, then jumped to Sigourney's fist. When the huntress lifted her arm and called out, "Hey!" the hawk took off, heading south. Sigourney flicked her fingers and Lady moved close to her side, awaiting instructions.
"What is your name?"
she asked the servant, noting the sleekness of his skin and the taut muscles beneath his blue silk shirt. He shook his head and moved away from her. Annoyed, the huntress walked from the old castle, crossing the rickety drawbridge and heading off into the woods. Her mood was dark and angry as she went. The mind of a whore, indeed. Her thoughts turned to Fell the forester. Now there was a man who understood pleasure. She doubted if there was a single woman within a day's walk who hadn't succumbed to his advances. Did they call him a whore? No, it was... Good old Fell, what a character, what a man!
Idiotic. As Medea's words rankled, she had thought him different, more... intelligent?
Yes. Instead, he proved to be like most men, caught between a need for fornication and a love of sermonizing. Abby soared above her, and Lady ran to the side of the trail, seeking out hares. Sigourney pushed thoughts of the black man from her mind and walked on in the dusk, coming at last to the final hillside and gazing down on her cabin. A light was showing at the window, and this annoyed her, for she wished to be alone this evening. If it was that fool Bent, she would give him the sharp side of her tongue. Walking into the yard, she whistled for Abby. The hawk came in low, then spread her wings and settled on Sigourney's glove. Feeding her a strip of meat, she removed the hunting jesses. Then carrying her to the bow perch, she attached the mew's ties and turned towards the cabin. Lady moved to the side of the building, lying down beside the door, with her head on her paws. Sigourney pushed open the door. Fell was sitting by the fire. Eyes closed, his long legs stretched out before the blaze. It angered her that she could feel a sense of rising excitement at his presence. He looked just the same as on that last day, his long black hair sleek and glowing with health, swept back from his brow and held in place by a leather headband, his beard close-trimmed and as soft as fur. Sigourney took a deep breath, trying to calm herself.
"What do you want here, goat brain?" she snapped.
Then she saw the blood. There were wolves all around him, fangs bared, ready to rip and tear. A powerful beast leapt at him, Fell caught it by the throat, then spun on his heel, hurling the creature into the pack. His limbs felt leaden, as if he were wading through water. The wolves, blurred, shifting like smoke, becoming tall, fierce-eyed warriors holding knives of sharpened bronze. They moved in on him, smoothly, slowly. Fell's arms were paralyzed, and he felt the first knife sink into his shoulder like a tongue of fire. He opened his eyes. Sigourney was kneeling beside him with a needle in her hand, and he felt the flap of flesh on his shoulder drawn tight by the thread. Fell swore softly.
"Lie still," she said,
and Fell obeyed her. His stomach felt uneasy. Snapping the thread with her teeth, she sat back.
"Looks like a sword cut."
"Long knife,"
he told her, taking a deep, shuddering breath. He said no more for a while, resting his neck against the thick, cushioned hide of the chair's headrest. Focusing his gaze on the far-timbered wall, he ran his eyes over the weapons hanging there. The long-handled broadsword with its leaf-shaped blade and hilt of leather, the bow of horn and the quiver of black-shafted arrows, the daggers and dirks, and lastly, the helm, with its crown and cheek-guards of black iron and the nasal guard and brows of polished brass. Not a speck of rust or tarnish showed on them.
"You keep your father's weapons in good condition," he said.
"That's what Gwal taught me," she told him. "Who gave you the wound?"
"We didn't exchange names. There were two of them. Robbed a pilgrim on the Lord Trail. I tracked them to Masgruff."
"Where are they now?"
"Oh, they're still there. I returned the money to the pilgrim and made a report to the watch."
His face darkened.
"Bastards. You could almost feel their disappointment.
He shook his head.
It won't be much longer, you know. They'll look for any excuse.
You've lost a lot of blood, she said. I'll make some broth. He watched her move away. His eyes lingered on the sway of her hips.
You're a beautiful woman, Sigourney. Never saw the like.
Look on and weep for all you've lost, she said, before disappearing into the back room.
Amen to that, he whispered.
Resting his head once more, he remembered the last parting 2 years before. Sigourney standing straight and tall and proud. Always so proud. Fel had walked across the glens to kill Fallon and paid bride price for Gwendolyn. Sweet Gwen. In no way did she match the silver-haired woman he had left, save in one. Gwen could bear children, and a man needed sons. 10 months later, Gwen was dead, the victim of a breech birth that killed both her and the infant. Fel had buried them both in the loader resting place on the western slope of Hydruin. Sigourney returned to his side. "Flex the muscles of your arm," she ordered. He did so and winced.
"It's damned sore."
"Good. I like to think of you in pain."
"I buried my son, woman. I know what pain is, and I'd not wish it on a friend."
"Neither would I," she said. "But you are no friend."
"Your mood is foul," he admonished her. "Had a falling out with your black man, have you?"
"Have you been spying on me, Fel?" It irritated him that she did not deny the association.
"It is my work, Sigourney. I patrol the forest, and I have seen you enter the castle. And I have seen you leave. How could you rut with such as he?"
She laughed then, and his anger rose. "Asmodeer is a better man than you, Fel, in every way." He wanted to strike her, to slap the smile from her face. But the growing nausea finally swamped him, and with a groan he pushed himself from the chair, staggered to the door, and just made it to open ground before falling to earth and vomiting. Cold sweat shone upon his face in the moonlight, and he felt weak as a day-old calf as he struggled to rise. Sigourney appeared alongside him, taking his arm and looping it over her shoulder. "Let's get you to bed," she said, not unkindly. Fel leaned into her. The scent of her filled his nostrils.
"I loved you,"
he said, as she half carried him up the 4 steps to the doorway. "You left me," she said. When he woke, it was daylight, the rising sun shining through the open window. The sky was clear, and Fel saw the hawk silhouetted briefly against the blue. With a groan he sat up. His shoulder was burning, and his ribs were badly bruised from the fight with the 2 outland robbers. Rising from the bed, he moved to the window. Sigourney was standing in the sunlight, the hawk on her glove, the black hound lying at her feet. Fel's mouth was dry, and all his long-suppressed emotions surged to the surface. Of all the women he had known, and there had been many, he had loved only one. And in that moment he knew with a sickening certainty that it would always be thus. Oh, he would marry again, and he would have sons. But his heart would remain with this enigmatic mountain woman until the daggers of time stopped its beat. Though still weak from loss of blood, Fel knew he could stay no longer in sight of Sigourney. Gathering his cloak of black leather, he pulled on his boots, took up his longbow and quiver, and walked from the rear of the cabin, heading back along the trail to kill Fallon. There was a maid there, of marriageable age, whose father had set a bride price Fel could afford.
"I hate this place," said the Baron Ranulf Gotterson, leaning on the wide parapet and staring out over the distant mountains.
Asmodeer said nothing. It was cold up here on the citadel's high walls, the wind hissing down from the north cutting through the warmest clothes. But the Baron seemed not to notice the inclemency of the weather. He was dressed in a simple shirt of black silk, and a sleeveless jerkin of the finest black leather. He wore no adornments, no silver enhancements to his black leather leggings, no chains or ornate discs attached to his knee-length boots. As Asmodeus stood shivering on the battlements, the Baron turned his pale, hooded eyes on the black man.
Not like Hushir, eh? Too cold, too bleak. Ever wish you were back home?
Sometimes, Asmodeus admitted, so do I. What is there here for a man like me? Where is the glory?
The kingdom is at peace, my lord,
said Asmodeus softly.
Thanks mainly to your good self and the Earl of Yostai.
The Baron's lips thinned, the hooded eyes narrowing.
Don't speak his name in my presence. I never met a man so gifted with luck. All his victories were hollow. Tell me what he has ever done to match my conquest of Lydia. 25,000 warriors against my 2 legions, yet we crushed them and took their capital. What can he offer against that? The siege of Catium. Pah!
Indeed, sir, said Asmodeus smoothly. Your deeds will echo through the pages of history. Now I am sure you have more important matters to attend to. So, how may I be of service to you?
The Baron turned and beckoned Asmodeus to follow him into a small study. The black man stared longingly at the cold and empty fireplace. Does the man not feel the cold, he wondered. The Baron seated himself at a desk of oak.
I want the Red Hawk, he said. There is a tourney in 2 months, and the Red Hawk could win it for me. Name a price.
Would that I could, sir, but I sold the hawk last autumn.
The Baron swore.
Who to? I'll buy it back.
I wouldn't know where to find the man, sir.
Asmodeus lied smoothly.
He came to my castle last year. He was a traveller, I believe, perhaps a pilgrim. But if I see him again, I shall direct him to you.
The Baron swore again, then lashed his fist against the desktop.
All right, that will be all,
he said at last. Asmodeus bowed and left the study. Descending the spiral staircase, he moved down into the belly of the fortress, emerging into the long hall, where the feast was in progress. Red liveried servants were carrying platters of food and drink, and more than 20 of knights and their ladies were seated at the 3 main tables. Fires were blazing merrily at both ends of the hall, and minstrels sat in the high gallery, their soft music drowned by the chatter of the guests. Asmodeus was not hungry. Swiftly he walked from the hall and down the long stairs to the lower chambers and the double-doored exit. His thoughts were sombre as he recalled the Baron's words. Asmodeus remembered the conquest of Lydia, the battles and the massacres, the rapes and the mutilations, the torture and the destruction. A rich, independent nation, brought to its knees, humiliated and beggared, its libraries burned, its holy places desecrated. Oh yes, Ranulf, history will long remember your bloody name. Asmodeus shivered. Revenge, so the proverb claimed, is a dish best served cold. Is that true, he wondered? Will there be any satisfaction in bringing the man down? Wrapping his cloak more tightly about his broad shoulders, Asmodeus left the fortress building and moved across the courtyard. A young man hailed him, and he turned and smiled at the newcomer. A tall young man, slender and brown-eyed, his long blonde hair drawn back from his brow and tied in a tight ponytail. He was carrying an armful of rolled maps.
Good afternoon, Leofric. You are missing the feast.
Yes, I know,
said the other dolefully.
But the Baron wants to study the maps. Doesn't pay to keep him waiting.
They look old.
They are. They were commissioned some 200 years ago by the Highland King, Gandarin the First. Fine work, most of them. Beautifully crafted. The mapmakers also had some method of judging the height of mountains. Did you know that Hydroin is 9,782 feet high? Do you think it could be true, or did someone just invent the figure?
Asmodeus shrugged.
It sounds too precise to be an invention. Still, I am glad you are enjoying your work.
I enjoy the detail, said Leofric, chuckling. Not many do. It pleases me to know how many lances we have and the state of our horses. I like working on projects like this. Did you know there are 412 wagons employed around the five towns?
The young man laughed.
Yes, I know. It is a little boring for most people, but you try to go on campaign without wagons and the war is over before it begins.
Asmodeir chatted with the young man for several minutes, then bade him farewell and walked swiftly to the stable. The hostler bowed as he entered, then saddled the chestnut gelding. Asmodeir gave the man a small silver coin.
Thank you, sir,
he said, pocketing the coin with a swiftness that dazzled the eye. Asmodeir rode from the stable through the portcullis gate and out into the wide streets of the town. He felt the eyes of the people upon him as he passed through the marketplace, and heard some children calling out names. A troop of soldiers marched past him, and he pulled up his horse. The men were mercenaries. They looked weary, as if they had marched many miles. Leofric planning the logistics of war. More mercenaries arriving every day.
The beast is not far off, thought Asmodeir.
Passing through the north gate, Asmodeir let the horse break into a run as it reached open ground. He rode thus for a mile, then slowed the beast. The chestnut was powerful, a horse bred for stamina, and he was not even breathing hard when Asmodeir reined him in. The black man patted the gelding's neck.
The dreams of men are born in blood, he said, softly.
Fel was sitting by the roadside, catching his breath, when the small two-wheeled cart moved into sight. Two huge grey wolfhounds were harnessed to it, and a silver-haired man sat at the front with a long stick in his hands. Seeing the forester, the old man tapped his stick lightly on the flanks of the hounds.
Hold up there, Shamwell. Hold up, Cabras. Good day to you, woodsman.
Fel smiled.
By heaven, Gwalch, you look ridiculous sitting in that contraption. Whist, boy, at my age I don't give a care to have a look,
said the old man.
What matters is that I can travel as far as I like without troubling my old bones.
Leaning forward, he peered at the forester.
You look greyer than a winter sky, boy. Are you ailing?
Wounded. I've shed some blood. I'll be fine, just need a rest is all.
Heading for Kilfallan.
Aye.
And climb aboard, young man. My hounds can pull two as well as one. Good exercise for them. We'll stop off at my cabin for a dram. That's what you need. Take my word for it. A little of the water of life and a promise not to tell your fortune.
You always tell my fortune, and that never makes good listening. But just this once I'll take you up on your offer. I'll ride that idiotic wagon. But I'll pray to all the gods I know that no one sees me on it. I'd never live it down.
The old man chuckled and moved to his right, making room for the forester. Fel laid his longbow and quiver in the back and stepped aboard.
Home now, hounds,
said Gwalch. The dogs lurched into the traces, and the little cart jerked forward. Fel laughed aloud.
I thought nothing would amuse me today,
he said.
You shouldn't have gone to her, boy,
said Gwalch.
No fortunes, you said,
the forester snapped.
Pah, that's not telling your fortune. That's a comment in moments past. And you can put that black man from your mind as well. He'll not win her. She belongs to the land, Fel. In some way she is the land. Sigourney the Hawk Queen, the hope of the Highlands.
The old man shook his head and then laughed as if at some private jest. Fel clung to the side of the cart as it rattled and jolted, the wheels dropping into the ruts in the trail, half tipping the vehicle.
By heaven, Gwalch, it is a most uncomfortable ride, complained the forester.
You think this is uncomfortable,
retorted the old man. Wait till we get to the top of my hill. The hounds always break into a run for home.
By Shimmick's balls, boy, it'll turn your hair grey.
The hounds toiled up the hill, pausing only briefly at the summit to catch their breaths. Then they moved on, rounding a last bend in the trail. Below them, Gwalch's timber cabin came into sight, and both dogs barked and began to run. The cart bounced and lurched as the dogs gathered speed, faster and faster down the steep slope. Fel could feel his heart pounding and his knuckles were white as he gripped the side rail. Ahead of them was a towering oak, the trunk directly in their path.
"The tree!"
shouted Fel.
"I know," answered Gwalch. "Best to jump." "Jump?"
echoed Fel, swinging to see the old man following his own advice. At the last moment, the dog swerved towards the cabin. The cart tipped suddenly, and Fel was hurled headfirst from it, missing the oak by inches. He hit the ground hard with the wind blasted from his lungs. Fel forced himself to his knees, just as Gwalch came ambling over.
"Great fun, isn't it?"
said the old man, stooping to take Fel by the arm and pull him to his feet. Fel looked into Gwalch's twinkling brown eyes.
"You are insane, Gwalch. You always were." "Life is to be lived, boy. Without danger, there is no life. Come and have a dram. We'll talk, you and I, of life and love, of dreams and glory. I'll tell you tales to fire your blood."
Fel found his longbow and quiver, gathered the fallen arrows, and followed the old man inside. It was a simple one-room dwelling, with a bed in one corner, a stone-built hearth in the north wall, and a rough-hewn table and two bench seats in the centre. Three rugs, two of oxskin, one of bear, covered the dirt floor, and the walls were decorated with various weapons. Two longbows, horn-tipped, several swords and a double-edged claymore. A male shirt was hanging on a hook beside the fire, its ring still gleaming, not a speck of rust upon it. On a shelf sat a helm of black iron, embossed with brass and copper. A battle axe was hanging over the fireplace, double-headed and gleaming.
"Ready for war, eh, old man?"
asked Fel as he sat down at the table. Gwalch smiled and filled a clay cup with amber liquid from a jug.
"Always ready, though no longer up to it," said the old man sadly. "That is a crying shame, for there's a war coming." "There's no war," said Fel irritably. "There's no excuse for one. The Highlands are peaceful. We pay our taxes. We keep the roads safe."
Gwalch filled a second cup and drained it in a single swallow.
"Those outland bastards don't need an excuse, Fel. And I can smell blood in the air. But that's for another day. And it is a little way off, so I won't let it spoil our drinking. So, tell me, how did she look?" "I don't want to talk about her." "Aye, but you do. She's filling your mind. Women all like that, bless them. I knew a girl once, Maeve, her name was. As bright and perfect a woman as ever walked the green hills, and hips, oh, the sway of them. She moved in with a cattle breeder from Gilcross. 11 babies, and all survived to manhood. Now that was a woman."
"You should have married her yourself,"
said Fel.
"I did,"
said Gwalch.
2 years we were together. Great years. All but wore me out, she did. But then I had my skull caved in during the battle at Ironbridge, and after that, the talent was on me. Couldn't look at a man or woman without knowing what was going on in their minds. Oh, Fel, you've no idea how irksome it is."
Gwalch sat down and filled his cup for a third time.
"To be lying on top of a beautiful woman, feeling her warmth and the soft silkiness of her. To be aflame with passion, and to know she's thinking of a sick cow with a dropping milk yield."
The old man laughed. Fel shook his head and smiled.
"Is that true?" "As true as I'm sitting here." I said to her one day, "Do you love me, woman?" She looked me in the eye and she said, "Of course I do." And do you know, she was thinking of the cattle breeder she'd met at the summer games, and into her mind came the memory of a roll in the hay with him. You must have thought of killing her,
said Fel, embarrassed by the confession.
Nah,
never was much of a lover. Roll on, roll off. She deserved a little happiness. I've seen her now and again. He's long dead, of course, but she goes on. Rich now. Widow of property.
Are all the weapons yours?
Asked Fel, changing the subject.
Aye, and all been used. I fought for the old king when we almost won, and I fought alongside the young fool who walked us on to Caldon Moor in extermination. Still don't know how I battled clear of that one. I was already nigh on 50. I won't be so lucky in the next one, though we'll have a better leader.
Who?
The old man touched his nose.
Now's not the time, Fel, and if I told you, you wouldn't believe me. Anyway, I'd sooner talk about woman. So tell me about Sigarni. You know you want to, or shall I tell you what you're thinking?
No,
said Fel sharply.
Fill another cup and I'll talk. Only the gods know why. Doesn't help.
Accepting the drink, he swallowed deeply, feeling the fiery liquid burn his throat.
Son of a whore, Gwalch! Is this made of rat's piss?
Only a touch, said the old man, just for colour. Now go on.
Why her? That's the question I ask myself. I've had more than my fair share of beautiful women. Why is it only she can fire my blood? Why?
Because she's special.
Gwalch rose from the table and moved to the hearth. A fire had been expertly laid, and he ignited his tinderbox, holding it below the cast-iron fire dog until flames began to lick at the dry twigs at the base. Kneeling, he blew on the tongues of flame until the thicker pieces caught. Then he stood.
Women like her are rare. Born for greatness. They're not made to be wives. Old before their time, with dry breasts drooping like hanged men. She's starlight, where other women are candle flames. You understand? You should feel privileged for having bedded her. She has the gift, Fel. The gift of eternity. You know what that means?
I don't know what any of this means,
admitted the forester.
It means she'll live forever. In 1,000 years, men will speak her name.
Fel lifted his cup and stared into the amber liquid.
Drinking this rots the brain, old man.
Aye, maybe it does. But I know what I know, Fel. I know you'll live for her, and I know you'll die for her.
Hold the right, Fel. Do it for me.
And they'll fall on you with their swords of fire and their lances of pain and their arrows of farewell. Will you hold Fel when she asks you?
Gwalch leaned forward and laid his head on his arms.
Will you hold, Fel?
You're drunk, my friend. You're talking gibberish.
Gwalch looked up, his eyes bleary.
I wish I was young again, Fel. I'd stand alongside you. By God, I'd even take that arrow for you.
Fel rose unsteadily, then helped Gwalch to his feet, carefully steered the old man to the bed, and laid him down. Returning to the fire, he stretched himself out on the bearskin rug, and slept. It was the closest Sigarni could come to flight. She stood, naked on the high rock beside the falls, and edged forward, her toes curling over the weather-beaten edge. 60 feet below, the waters of the pool churned as the falls thundered into it. The sun was strong on her back, the sky as blue as gemstone. Sigarni raised her arms and launched her body forward. Straight as an arrow she dived, arms flung back for balance, and watched the pool roar up to meet her. Bringing her arms forward at the last moment, she struck the water cleanly, making barely a splash. Down, down she sank until her hands touched the stone at the base of the pool. Spinning, she used her feet to propel her body upwards. Once more on the surface, she swam with lazy grace to the south of the pool, where Lady anxiously waited. Hauling herself clear of the water, she sat on a flat rock and shook the water from her hair. The sound of the falls was muted here, and the sunlight was streaming through the long leaves of a willow, dappling the water with flecks of gold.